We're so glad you're all here. Thank you very much for coming. I want to introduce Dr. Crosby by letting you know that Jules and I have had many great teachers in our life, undeservedly great teachers. But of all the teachers that we've had, Dr. Crosby is by far the most formative for us, the one who has most shaped our view of reality, our understanding of philosophy, and the one we most try to imitate in our own doing of philosophy. And I think this is not only because of the content of what he taught, but also particularly his way of philosophizing, which is typically, I think, very personalistic in the sense of its being very, he has a way of sympathetically entering into the mind of other thinkers and then revealing them to the minds of his students, because he has the same mode in his teaching, a very sympathetic openness and receptivity to his students that enables a kind of, in our experience, a depth of encounter with the philosophers that we were reading that is exceptional, and we're so grateful to that. And maybe, for me at least, the best course I ever had with Dr. Crosby was a course on the thought of John Henry Newman. So, and then this, maybe the second, maybe it's advised for also for first place was a course in the philosophy of the person. So when we found he was writing a book on the philosophy, the personalism of John Henry Newman, it was a sort of, this is perfect. But he did tell me a couple of years ago that he was writing a book and he was calling it My Walk with Newman. And then when we saw him this summer and he said the title now is The Personalism of John Henry Newman, I asked him about that. What happened? What changed? And he said he had decided to move it more in the direction of a more objective analysis of Newman's personalism and less about his own journey. So we asked him when he came, well, would you share with us your own journey here with Newman? Because I'm very interested in hearing that. And I also think more and more we are interested in the Personalist Project with this element of sharing, of opening our hearts, our own experience, our own understanding, and exchanging our ideas with one another. So that's what we hope to do tonight, and we're very glad that Dr. Crosby could come. And we'll begin, and then we hope you all feel free to ask questions afterwards and share your own thoughts and favorite elements of Newman or whatever. So with that, we'll begin.
Well, thank you very much, Judy, for the invitation to come and for the warm words of introduction. A teacher doesn't need to have many students like Jules and Katie have been in order to feel that all of his labors are worth it and richly rewarded. It's meant a great deal to me to have a few students who really receive what I wanted to give, and then they take it and do something creative with it themselves, like you're doing with the Personalist Project, and that is immensely rewarding for me. It gives me a strong grandfatherly feeling toward you, Jules. As you see from what Katie said, I'm not really going to give a talk on Newman or anything like a lecture or inform you, but rather give a very personal, that's what I think she's asking for, a personal account of what kind of role he's played in my life and how he has accompanied me, as it were, throughout my life. And so be advised of this very personal character, and therefore I speak just freely from notes and invite you at any moment to break in with questions or with requests for some clarification, or Katie may want to pull me in a different direction. So,
John, could you speak a little bit louder?
Yes. Newman and I go back more than 50 years. I had a revered grandfather who loved Newman, and he, when I was maybe 15, said, you know, you should really read this great Catholic writer. And so, following that very early direction that I got from my grandfather, I did. At 15, 16, 17, read in works like his Apologia, his great autobiography, and The Grammar of Assent, the Essay on Doctrinal Development, and my first reaction was that Newman has a clarity of mind like I'd never found it in any other author. I read lots of thinkers in college when I was an undergraduate at Georgetown, but Newman was clear and intelligible, like no one else was for me. So my first impression was of an intellectual power that can illuminate things, like at least no one else in my experience had. But then the real formative encounter with Newman came for me when I was about 20 and began reading and rereading in the great sermons of Newman, most of them Anglican sermons, since most of his published sermons are from the Anglican period. And the reading of these sermons, that had a really transforming effect on me. One young man in Oxford who heard Newman preach said many, many years later, recollecting the experience of Newman in Oxford, he said, "He turned our souls inside out." And so it was somehow instrumental for me, these sermons of Newman. They were instrumental in undergoing a kind of conversion. I'm a cradle Catholic, but every born Catholic has to undergo some conversion where they make the faith they've received their own. And so for me, that decisive conversion and owning the Catholic faith in which I had been born was somehow Newman's preaching in Oxford. That was the human instrument for this conversion. And so let me maybe try to just say a little more about exactly what Newman did for me in turning my soul inside out. Just say a word about what Newman was opposing as a preacher. And then I think what he taught stands out more clearly. So Newman, and I'm going to share with you from my own book here one passage from one of the Oxford sermons. It's from The Religion of the Day. You know, he characterizes, I'll just say it in my own words, which is a great loss. In Newman's words, it's not quite where I thought I had marked it. But Newman had the idea that religion had become, in England, in his day, harmless. It had become trivialized. And that it was all about a certain social decency, but that a real religious substance was missing, and that's what he wanted to recover with his preaching. And so from that sermon, The Religion of the Day, I will cite this, where he expresses his response to it, almost as revulsion at this aesthetic kind of religion, this religion all on the surface. He says, "Here I will not shrink from uttering my firm conviction that it would be a gain to this country, were it vastly more superstitious, more bigoted, more gloomy, more fierce in its religion than at present it shows itself to be. Not, of course, that I think the tempers of mind therein implied desirable, which would be an absurdity, but I think them infinitely more desirable and more promising than a heathen obduracy and a cold, self-sufficient, self-wise tranquility. And so human discerning the unreality and the lack of real religious substance in the religion of the day try to recover the real thing. Now, I do have the other passage from another sermon that I wanted to share with you, where Newman wonderfully captures this unreality of religion. It's in fact entitled Unreal Words. And Newman here speaks of, and this is supposed to capture somehow the spirit of this religion of the day that provoked Newman's opposition. He speaks of the mode in which people speak of the shortness and vanity of life, the certainty of death, the joys of heaven. They have commonplaces in their mouths, which they bring forth upon occasions for the good of others or to console them, or as a proper and becoming mark of attention toward them. Thus they speak to clergymen in a professedly serious way, making remarks true and sound and in themselves deep, yet unmeaning in their mouths. Or when they fall into sin, they speak of man being frail, of the deceitfulness of the human heart, of God's mercy, and so on. All these great words, heaven, hell, judgment, mercy, repentance, works, the world that now is, the world to come, being little more than lifeless sounds in their mouths and ears, as the proprieties of conversation or the civilities of good breeding. And so Newman fights to recover the real thing of authentic religion, precisely in response to this harmless, trivialized, aestheticized religion that he found all around him in England. And that's what made such an impression on me in the sermons. Newman conveyed to me a sense of the living God, not the God of the philosophers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he conveyed a sense of this God who is, as it says in Scripture, a consuming fire, a God into whose hands it is terrible to fall. And what very particularly caught my attention was all that Newman said about religious fear. It turned out that he wasn't talking about a fear of God punishing, but fear in the sense of a kind of awe of God, of the holiness of God. And that somehow conveyed to me, as it did to very many people who heard Newman, a whole new sense of what it is to have to do with the living God. And this fear, so convincingly expressed, wasn't a servile fear, but a kind of reverential awe and spirit of adoration that Newman brought to the encounter with God. Also, in Newman, I saw this unconditional adherence to God. What that means, having encountered the living God, to turn to him as a creature, adhering unconditionally to him. That broke in upon me with a tremendous force and was really the heart and soul of a kind of conversion, a kind of awakening as if for the first time to what religion is and what the Christian faith really is. So I've often said to my friends that I received the Christian faith from the preaching of this Anglican priest. Newman says in one place, speaking of Thomas Scott, a British religious writer, a little before his time, Newman says, "I owe him, humanly speaking, my soul." And so I've always felt that this encounter with Newman's preaching in the new world, you might say, of God and of religion, the way he brought that home to me, that gives me a debt to him, like he said he had to Thomas Scott. Now, I will just add one thing, since I'm supposed to speak in an autobiographical vein here, that this encounter with Newman's sermons that worked such a religious revolution in my mind and heart, that was in the late 60s, right after the close of the council. And what I experienced in Newman had the effect of giving me a kind of critical distance to the council, because there was abroad in the church, in the immediate wake of the council, the late 60s, early 70s, a great deal of trivialized religion. It showed up especially in the liturgy. And I felt very strongly what I'm getting from Newman, this prophet of authentic Christianity, of radical apostolic Christianity, what I'm getting from Newman is cut from a different cloth from this post-conciliar spirit with its religious cheerfulness and harmlessness. And, there was, I felt on the one hand I was somehow protected from certain bad influences in the air, but on the other hand, it definitely gave me a critical reserve about the council. And later on, I found the way through the interpretation that John Paul gave to Vatican II to make it too my home. But initially, there was this quite understandable way of being turned off somehow by the very force of Newman's preaching. So that's just a word on my encounter with his sermons. Now, I want to go on to mention a problem I've always had with Newman. I've honored him here and acknowledged this, owing him my very soul. And yet, if you ask me to speak in a more personal vein, I would also say that I always felt there would be a certain undertone in Newman that was at least affected me in a discouraging way. It's as if there's something about the mercy of God and the power of God's mercy and the divine resourcefulness in seeking out the lost and showing his mercy that I missed in Newman. And that often had a somewhat discouraging effect. I'll show you just one passage which represents this side of Newman that others too have noticed. And so here I feel almost guilty saying something critical of my father in the faith, so this is actually a Catholic sermon, one of the Discourses to Mixed Congregations, where Newman It's on the gift of perseverance. He's talking about the difficulty of persevering at the end. And he brings his congregation almost to the edge of despair with the following train of thought. He says, for instance, "Oh, my dear children, how subdued our rejoicing in you is, even when you are walking well and hopefully. How anxious are we priests, for you, even when you are cheerful from the lightness of your conscience and the sincerity of your hearts. How we sigh when we give thanks for you and tremble, even while we rejoice in hearing your confessions and absolving you. And why? Because we know how great and high is the gift of perseverance." And then he goes on, "How many, when led forward by God's unmerited grace, are influenced by the persuasions of relatives or the inducements of station or of wealth, and become in the end skeptics or infidels, when they might have almost died in the odor of sanctity? How many whose contrition once gained for them even the grace of justification, yet afterwards, by refusing to go forward, have gone backwards, though they maintain a semblance of what they once were? What a miserable wreck is the world! Hopes without substance, promises without fulfillment, repentance without amendment, blossom without fruit, continuance and progress without perseverance." And then Newman is somehow mindful that he is bringing his listeners to the very edge of despair. And it's quite remarkable what he says and doesn't say. He just says, "Well, if you're made anxious by my meditation on perseverance, that's all to the good. It may help you to avoid this final falling away." And what he does not say right at this moment is, "Throw yourself onto the mercy of God. His mercy is greater than your heart. Rising above all this anxiety and counting on something much greater than our own anxious heart." Now let me move to another aspect of Newman's that has meant a lot to me. You know, I'm a professor of philosophy, so I'm always working with ideas and always intellectually working and making arguments and drawing distinctions. That's sort of my daily bread. And the occupational hazard that goes with that kind of work, namely that you make too much of reason and analysis and fall into a kind of rationalism where this rational activity gets overrated. And I must say that Newman has again and again been an inestimable blessing by giving me more than just analytic reason, by appealing to the heart in a deeper way than philosophers do when they make their arguments. And so I wanted to, in this respect, show you, I chose it as the motto of the whole book from his apologia, that indicates how Newman himself saw the limits of rational argument and saw the need for something that goes deeper in the human heart than arguments. And so he famously says in his apologia, "I am far from denying the real force of the arguments in proof of a God, but these do not warm me or enlighten me. They do not take away the winter of my desolation or make the buds unfold and the leaves grow within me and my moral being rejoice." So there's some more heartfelt knowledge of God that will make the leaves grow within him and his moral being rejoice that Newman seeks. And in the most various ways, I would receive that again and again by reading Newman and reflecting on his life and reading in his correspondence. There was a very powerful mind at work, a penetrating intellect, but more than that, there was also this a very great human heart and an ability to speak to the heart and touch the heart. That, as I say, was like a bulwark against this this rationalism that I would naturally incline to through all the intellectual work. Then there's something else in Newman that shows him working on me, but in a non-intellectual way. He asks in an early Anglican sermon, what's the true way in which truth, revealed truth, revelation, gets transmitted from one person to another? And he answers there, and I quote him, that revelation has been upheld in the world, not as a system, not by books, not by arguments, nor by temporal power, but by the personal influence of such men, as have already been described, certain holy men, who are at once the teachers and patterns of Christian truth. So the sermon is entitled Personal Influence, the True Method of Propagating Truth. And so he goes on to characterize it like this: men persuade themselves with little difficulty to scoff at principles, to ridicule books, to make sport of the names of good men, but they cannot bear their presence, that is, the presence of good men. It is holiness, embodied in personal form, which they cannot steadily confront and bear down, so that the silent conduct of a conscientious man secures for him from beholders a feeling different in kind from any which is created by the mere versatile and garrulous reason. And then, finally, this from that same sermon: the attraction exerted by unconscious holiness is of an urgent and irresistible nature. It persuades the weak, the timid, the wavering, and the inquiring. It draws forth the affections and loyalties of all who are, in a measure, like-minded. So there is this mystery of personal influence that works at a deeper level than just making arguments and giving reasons. And I found in Newman not only a wise teaching personal influence, but a wonderful practice of it. Newman has the most extraordinary ability, so I experienced him, to make himself present in his words and in that way to address you heart to heart. And so he exercises a personal influence that far exceeds the mere force of the argumentation and reasoning that he offers in his writings. And so that has been enormously nourishing for me, this personal influence of Newman exercised through his writings, whereas he said he heart speaks to heart. And it's a very special gift, because if you think of other great Catholic writers like St. Thomas Aquinas, you have to say that they declare the truth and utter and enunciate the truth in an awe-inspiring way, but they remain themselves somehow hidden. They don't reveal themselves in the truth they profess. Nobody would think of taking the Summa of St. Thomas and inscribing over it, "Heart speaks to heart," Newman's motto as cardinal. It's mind speaks to mind. But in Newman, there is this human heart, and with this power of making itself present so that you are addressed and challenged by his teaching. So that too was a nourishment that I received from Newman at a much deeper than purely a rational analytic level. And that has been, for me, like an antidote to a chronic failing, that over-relying on the rational, this making the heart expand like the buds of a flower, and this power of personal witness gave me a particular nourishment, and still does to this day. Then one other thing in Newman that I want to mention here, and that is what I would call, as I have experienced, an extraordinary power of sympathy. He has, and this may be connected with the personal influence of which I just spoke, but it's a distinct thing. Someone who heard Newman preach in Oxford remembered him like this. This is, seems to me exactly right. He sets before persons their own feelings with such truth of detail, such natural expressive touches, that they seem to be no ordinary states of mind, seem not to be ordinary states of mind, which everyone has, but very peculiar ones. For he, Newman, and the reader seem to be the only two persons in the world that have them in common. Persons look into Mr. Newman's sermons and see their own thoughts in them. And I must say, over the years, again and again, I go back to Newman with this or that inner need, this or that distress, perplexity, temptation, and I invariably find something there that where Newman interprets to me and communicates this mysterious sympathy by the way he understands what I experience. But that power of entering into the experience of others and of helping you understand yourself through a certain sympathy, that's a very amazing thing in Newman that I have felt again and again. And the interesting thing is that Newman was very aware of the fact that he had this gift of interpreting you to yourself. One of the most moving lines in all of the sermons of Newman is from this very last sermon he preached as an Anglican, where he writes, he said at the end of the sermon entitled The Parting of Friends, "And, O my brethren, O kind and affectionate hearts, O loving friends, should you know anyone," speaking of himself here in the third person, "who has ever told you what you knew about yourselves, or what you did not know, has read to you your wants or feelings, and comforted you by the very reading, remember such a one in time to come, though you hear him not." So he was aware that he had this gift of entering into what people feel and somehow explaining them to themselves. So that power of sympathy and the communication of it is a marvel about me. Again and again been comforted again and again by that. And then maybe just one last thing. I'm probably speaking too long here. And but one last thing about Newman that has really been upbuilding for me. And it's a certain kind of truthfulness that I find in him. And it shows itself like this. Newman, in debate with adversaries of Christianity or of Catholicism or of religion altogether, in debate with them, Newman shows the most extraordinary fairness, the most extraordinary ability to hear the truth being said in by his opponent. One person who heard him preach remarked that he had this power of understanding even the unbeliever. He writes, and there are many wonderful remembrances of Newman, and many people experienced him in ways that I completely identify with and can make my own. So one such person who heard Newman said, "Nay, he enters deeply into what even skepticism has to say for itself. He puts himself into the infidel's state of mind, in which the world as a great fact seems to give the lie to all religions, converting them into phenomena, which counterbalance and negative each other. And he goes down into that lowest abyss and bottom of things, at which the intellect undercuts spiritual truth altogether." And so it's connected with the power of sympathy, of entering into the mind of another. But what I particularly want to get is that in his encounter with his opponents, that he shows this extraordinary fairness to them, this careful listening to whatever may be true in what they hold. And you might think, well, if you are always saying, well, you've got a point and there's truth in what you say, that you end up with a kind of muted version of Christianity, sort of conceded too much. But the wonder in Newman is that by being so fair-minded and so alert to everything true in his opponent, he is able to state his own Christian and Catholic view with a particular force, because it's as if he has a way of finding the place for truth and for the truth in this and that opponent. He finds its place in a larger whole. And then Christian revelation gets its place, and then revelation becomes very convincing. I mean, Newman has really overcome his adversary by the fact that he doesn't just ridicule them or dismiss them out of hand, but has a certain capaciousness of mind where he can find the place for different truths. And rejecting, of course, what's erroneous in the opponent. But somehow Newman has, through this truthfulness of him, as I call it, he somehow reinforced my confidence in truth. In that, you know, I don't have to, when somebody raises a plausible objection, I don't have to ridicule it. I don't have to make a straw man out of it. I don't have to dismiss it quickly. I can face it. I can hear him out. I can try to discern whatever's true in it. And if I do that, according to the example of Newman, my own statement of the true position will be all the more convincing, all the more powerful. I don't know any writer who does that like Newman does, who captures all the strands and fragments of truth and somehow brings them into a larger whole and shows you know, the place of Christian revelation in that whole. It's It's a wonderful thing. And this will be my last quote from him. The passage I quote too many times in the book. I think I quote it in three different places. So I evidently think it's an important one. But it somehow connected with this a certain capaciousness of mind, a certain vastness of mind, in which there are many mansions. A wonderful passage from his essay on the development of Christian doctrine. He says, "But one aspect of revelation must not be allowed to exclude or to obscure another. And Christianity is dogmatical, devotional, practical, all at once. It is esoteric and exoteric. It is indulgent and strict. It is light and dark. It is love and it is fear." And this combining of apparent opposites into a larger whole is an extraordinary power of Newman. And it's connected with his truthfulness, his ability to not let one truth interfere with another, but each have its own place, even when they seem to be opposed to each other. There's, you know, the theologians say that we have to think of God as a kind of union of apparent opposites. And Newman reflects that in an amazing way, with this union of apparent opposite aspects of truth in his thought and in his way of engaging adversaries. So that, as I say, it's something in Newman that has built up my confidence in truth. Somehow encourage me to be utterly honest in facing objections and not think that I'm doing truth a favor by ridiculing the opponent. So those are the main things in Newman I wanted to bring out, and excuse me for talking too long. It's I'd certainly be more to say, but those are what first came to mind.